I've been reading the book Renegade, The Making of a President. But then again, we saw a lot of your work throughout the campaign, both through Newsweek and MSNBC, where your presence is much enjoyed.
Thank you. I love being on the show. I have been from pretty much the start of the show, 5 or 6 years ago now.
Wow. Tell us, I mean, we've heard recently that this book was actually the idea of President Obama. He came to you and said, why don't you, since you're covering me anyway, why don't you write a book?
He did. And I told him it was a stupid idea, which wasn't very diplomatic of me or very sensible. But I thought that in the sort of age of blogs and cable TV, the genre of sort of campaign books was over and publishers weren't interested in it much anymore. And he was a bit disappointed. I guess I was a little bit rough. But he said he loved the Teddy White books, and I do too, but they were a long time ago. So I kind of went away and thought about it and realized, as my family and friends and coworkers pointed out, that I was the stupid one, and decided that there was a book in it, but it was more of a book about him and using the campaign as biography than really a pure election book. Teddy White wrote about all the candidates. I write just about one. And instead of sort of going from New Hampshire to Iowa or Iowa to New Hampshire and South Carolina all the way up to the election, Teddy White kind of does that linear thing. I wanted to make it thematic to try and peel away some of the layers of this guy who I think is kind of hidden and obscure and intentionally so.
Right. Let me ask you, what do we get in the book Renegade that we didn't get in the brilliant, you know, I think it was a 10-part series that Newsweek did on the campaign that came out after the campaign was over?
My former colleagues at Newsweek did a great job. They really were looking, though, to retell the sort of behind the scenes of the election and from start to finish. And my book is, again, about this guy who the Secret Service calls Renegade and about what makes him successful as a renegade, which is a combination of the discipline and caution with the renegade sort of risk-taking and unconventional politics that he does. And the question of who is he, it seems to me something that is not just about how did he win or what were the conversations before. Now, I got stuff that my old colleagues at Newsweek didn't get, sort of nuggets of news that people find interesting. But the real value of the book is, I think, in painting this portrait of a guy who, yeah, he's very comfortable in public and speaking out on a big stage, but he's actually really more comfortable on his own, and he's a bit of a policy wonk and a loner. And telling that story and revealing where that character comes from and how it unfolds on the public stage, I think, is what I was trying to do with Renegade. So it's a different kind of book.
Yes, and I'm loving it. I'm about, about a halfway through, and this is one that I will finish. And when you do,
I'm honored, actually, because I know what it's like not finishing books. I do
right.
that all the time.
Of course, because and I get ready for an interview, and then I get so far into it, and then I have to go on to the next one. But this is going to go on the stack that I definitely want to finish. Richard Wolff is with us here on Air America Radio. And what's the one thing about President Obama that most people would be surprised? I mean, let me ask you this one. We hear that he's unflappable. He's so cool. We see that. But you said in the book that he's not always that calm and collected.
No, he's not. He has moods. He can be moody. He can be irritable and angry. I've seen it happen to me. And look, he can screw up. I mean, you know, everyone looks at him now and says, well, everything was always destined to be this way. And it's also polished. And you know, for most of the election, certainly for 2007, that first year of the two-year campaign, he wasn't a good candidate. He hated it. He had disputes with his staff and with everybody else, and it took him time to work at being a good candidate. And so I think people might be surprised to find that he's human, that he makes mistakes, that he learns from them and works hard to be a better candidate and be a better policy wonk and president, but you know, at the heart of it, there is someone who has flaws and moods and emotions, and it's very rare. It's rare that he even cracks a joke in public. And believe me, he cracks jokes. They're just kind of edgy ones, and we saw a glimpse of it the other day when he joked about breaking into the White House and getting shot.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, You know, that's not your typical kind of bland political humor.
Right. I agree. Now, let's talk about that, Dave, because before he said that, he also said that the officer who arrested Skip Gates acted stupidly. There's one of his mistakes. I'm sure he wishes he could take that word in that moment back.
Well, he kind of has. I mean, he said either he said or one of his spokesmen said that it was stupid to use the word stupid. And look, he's chosen bad words before when he was talking about small town America and said that people were bitter for one reason or another.
Right.
So for a writer, for someone who's generally very careful about what he says, yeah, he can pick the wrong word. And especially in a cultural war like this about race, that was unwise. But the sentiment behind it, I think, is still real and true. And he finds it outrageous that someone, especially a friend, would get arrested in their own home because an argument got out of hand. And that is an all too common story of race in America.
Yes, it is. And since then, he's been dealing with it adequately. But this is a real distraction from the bigger issue right now that the country is embroiled in, and that is health care reform.
Yeah, it is a distraction. And I think that's what they regret most of all, because it's allowed the opponents, his political opponents, to wallow in the distraction. They love talking about something else. This cultural stuff energizes their own base and serves to tarnish his intentions on a whole range of things. So this is not a happy debate for them to have.
I'm sure. We're speaking with Richard Wolff, author of Renegade, The Making of a President. You conducted a number of one-on-one interviews with Barack Obama. You spent 2 years with him on the campaign trail. Did you forge a friendship? Are you friends now?
Oh, I don't know about that. You know, for a start, a reporter and a subject, especially a politician, you've got to be kind of a little bit delusional to think that that's a normal relationship or that you can have a friendship in that sense. I mean, I tell you, we certainly respect each other. At least I think he respects me. But, you know, I respected George W. Bush, too, and I'm sure a lot of your listeners didn't. I mean, I think if you get to know someone like that, it's hard to idealize them or demonize them. But generally, people in politics, even politics I disagree with for whatever reason, most people are in politics because they want to take the country to a better place. So they want to, you know, you may disagree about the ideology, but their purposes generally are based around some part of principle. They may lose sight of those principles, but they start off in a pretty good place, even if they don't end up there. So I generally think that I have respect for him. I certainly developed that respect by seeing how seriously he took the process. The one thing that really drove me crazy, I have to admit, was watching something like Sarah Palin happen. Not because I think Sarah Palin is in and of herself a joke, but when I saw that she wasn't taking things seriously, like giving a policy speech and not really having policy, that kind of stuff really annoys me.
Well, it does me too, and that's one of my questions here. Did he ever talk about her? Now, I know he had to be guarded in speaking with you, knowing that anything he said was on the record, but did he ever just throw up his hands and say, what the hell are they thinking with her?
Well, he told me for the book that he thought it was a Hail Mary pass when they picked her, and that they were desperate in the sense that they didn't really have their base locked down, and McCain was in deep trouble. And now they were even more scornful behind the scenes, and they had to tone that down when they were going public with their comments. They did a bit of it, and it got them into some trouble. So on the first day she came out, they were kind of scornful in public, and then they said, actually, Obama, as candidate, said, oh, but I have great respect for her life story, and she's got a very compelling story, and that kind of thing. You can't really do both or think both, and they didn't. So, you know, they had to temper their comments, but in private, they thought it was a sign of real weakness for McCain. And in the end, she helped Obama raise a ton of money, something like $25 million, as I explained in Renegade. She helped them raise, which helped fund that primetime TV show they put on. I mean, those things are expensive, and they had Sarah Palin to thank for that.
Oh, well, that's good to know. What gets me is just last week she gave this big resignation speech where she talked about, she shook her finger at the press, basically, and said, maybe in honor of the soldiers, you will stop making things up, right? And all I could think was,
in honor of the soldiers.
In honor of the soldiers, right. You'll stop making things up. And we could talk about her making things up, the palling around with terrorists that she went ad nauseum on. But just look at what the people on the right are making up today, the whole birther nonsense.
They're doing that for the troops, though.
Yes, of course they are.
They're doing that in support of the troops.
Have you spoken with the president about this birther conspiracy theory?
Not recently, but it's not new.
I mean,
this stuff came up in the election.
That's
One of the things that's most sort of puzzling about its resurface now is that the McCain campaign looked at this stuff. And they had more of an interest in exposing this and following it as a story than anybody else, because they could have killed their opponent. And they could have won the election if any of this was true. And they found that it wasn't true. So,
of course.
You know, you have to be a really sick kind of conspiracist to think that the McCain campaign somehow passed this up because they wanted to lose. And so, yeah, I talked to him about the conspiracies. It was, remember, there were many of them. There were, that his wife had given some kind of racist speech, or that he was really Muslim, or all of that stuff. I actually think the Muslim thing was more damaging and just as pervasive. And he was frustrated with how the technology was working against them, in the sense that you could beat it down in one place, but it would pop up somewhere else. And then it was being driven and propagated by people like Fox News. And so, they set up a website, the myth-busting website, to deal with it. It had some impact. You can sort of make it more fringy by putting it out there as being not true, but it doesn't stop it. It just sort of quarantines it.
Right, right. Let me ask you this, and maybe you have an insight that I can't get to. Why is Barack Obama here? He won with an overwhelming majority. The Democrats have 60 members in the Senate. They have a ridiculous majority in the House. Why is he so insistent on bipartisan support to the point where it looks like the health care reform is falling apart? And what I'm seeing from the White House in the last 48 hours is a changing of the vernacular. It's no longer health care reform they're talking about. They're talking now about health insurance reform, which are two different things. Why doesn't he just ram his most important policy through while he's got the political capital and strength to do so?
Well, he may end up having to do that. But for a start, he doesn't have 60 votes on a lot of this stuff because there are, once Democrats are winning essentially purple and even red states, there are Democratic senators especially who are vulnerable if they're voting against what is popular opinion in
but,
their
but
own
what,
states.
But why can't he use his strength and his power and his clout to say, okay, you can vote against the final bill, but vote for cloture so that they only need 50 votes to pass it? Because all they need to do is vote to end the filibuster.
I suspect they'll end up doing that, but you end up in this sort of 10-year phase of legislation, which you have to renew. So it's not their starting point, but I think they'll probably end up doing that. And here's the other aspect to it, because one that focuses on how do you get stuff done, the other focus is on wanting to look reasonable. It's not because they think they're going to get lots of Republican votes. They don't think that. They're not naive. But the independent voters who really put him over the top, the people who held the key to 2008 and will again in 2012 are people who don't care for this partisan stuff. And they want to know that Obama is open to Republican ideas and he's making a good faith effort to bring them on board. And that's what almost a definition of a real independent is. And so you hear him talking about taking on Republican ideas, Republican amendments, and being open to negotiate and take on their and compromise in some way. I mean, if you're going to unite red and blue America, you are a compromise politician. You are a candidate who looks, and a politician who looks for consensus. So, Democrats kind of have to remember that was the key part of his philosophy and his appeal.
Yeah, but still, we also voted for him because he promised universal health care. And, I guess we'll see what happens.
Well,
he didn't promise single payer.
They never talk about universal health care. You see, that's one of the key things. He gives people a sense that he is totally with them. But he talked about expanding coverage. He talked about near universal health care. They don't even talk about the word universal anymore.
I know they don't.
That, to me, is a more important linguistic definition.
Yeah, I guess you're right. But he did promise real reform, and what we're seeing now is not that. And I know the process isn't over yet. And there are some of us who are still hoping that he will do what we voted for him to do. Richard Wolf is with us. I got two quick more questions because I know we're against the clock. You filled in for Keith Olbermann the other night hosting Countdown. How'd you like doing that?
It's a lot harder than it looks. I'm doing it tonight, though, again.
You
so
are.
You can see if I've improved at all.
Okay. Well, we'll check that out. And the other is Ben Affleck on Saturday Night Live did a great job lampooning Keith. And Fred Armisen did you.
What was Fred Armisen, the height of my career, and the funny thing is, I didn't have anything to do with it, I thought it was hilarious. And as Keith said to me, I came off a whole lot better than he did. But we both really loved it. It was a special treat for us all. I think, to be honest, to be played by the same guy who plays Barack Obama, I think actually kind of annoyed Barack Obama. So I think he was hoping that some other guy would play me.
Very funny. It was a classic. Richard Wolf, a pleasure to speak with you. I've been a fan of your work for a long time, and I'm glad we finally had the chance to talk. Thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thanks for having me on.